I'd like to call the, today's date is Wednesday, March 1st. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Little technical glitch here. We had photocopy machine problems this morning, so we've got the minutes for you being handed out. We'll get to those in just a minute. Anything else for the benefit of the group this morning, Representative Fisher? You look like you were going to say something.
Nope.
Okay. We've got a number of different bills before us this morning, so we'd like to try to expedite the process as much as possible. The first bill is going to be House File 771, so I'd like the testifiers to come down at this time while we're kind of getting organized here. We have a fill-in to my right this morning. A very capable Bobby Patrick is filling in to a certain degree for Ms. Zipko. Representative Hanson.
He must be here for my birthday.
He is. Yes. Oh, Representative Hanson.
I thought you were bringing stuff in to treat.
I bought dinner for a few people last night, but...
Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow. What's the name of that? The bakery that Representative McNair, was it Emily's or something? You probably should stop there and make a little...
Danny's donuts.
Okay, good. Okay, members, we have the minutes from February 28th before us. Representative Torkelson, would you move the minutes, please?
I'd be happy to do so, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you, members. House File 771. This is the chair's bill, Representative Hanson.
It's a nice shortcut.
All right. Some of you have listened to me. I'll do a brief bill introduction here. And then we do have one amendment. I'll probably move the A-17 amendment. I'd like to move House File 771 to move to the General Register. And then I'd also like to move the A-17 amendment. So let's just act on the bill first. House File 771. Move to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And then the that's motion carried. House A-17 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. This is a delete all. So all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Sure.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment's adopted. So the bill is in the order that the author would like. The demolition landfill issue is one that we've heard about before. Mike Hanen has been here to testify before. Mr. Carlson has been here. This is an issue that's kind of burning in rural Minnesota. We have a number of demo landfills that are not being re-permitted, and the permitting process is going very slow. It's something that we talked about yesterday. Not that it's necessarily directly related to House File 1291, but it is an ongoing issue. So hopefully this bill will address that, and we can work with the Pollution Control Agency to make sure that our demo landfills in rural Minnesota continue to operate and function properly. So with that, Mr. Carlson, I'll turn it over to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning,
and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I represent the Lyon County Board of Commissioners, one of my very first clients. I represent them since 1993, and they operate a solid waste program. Is the microphone on?
I think you're on. But.
Is that better, Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
Thank you. So I represent the Lyon County Board of Commissioners and seven counties in southwestern Minnesota that run a regional solid waste facility. And we are part of a landfill operators group, which are publicly operated solid waste facilities around the state. And that's why we're here in front of you today. The DE amendment that you adopted addresses a backlog of permits that we're hoping to move through the process. The language that in the DE amendment is some language we've worked out with the MPCA to help expedite this process. So it's not anything that we're forcing on them. We've worked cooperatively with them to try and address the permit backlog for those facilities where it's appropriate, and we appreciate the committee adopting it. I'm going to have Mike talk a little bit about their experience in Otter Tail County, and then we're happy to answer any questions that you might have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mike Heenan, I'm Solid Waste Director for Otter Tail, Todd, and Wadena Counties in West Central Minnesota. Between the three counties, we own and operate four very small demolition landfills. Our facilities typically take in less than 10,000 cubic yards in a year, and we have two of them right now that are permits are expired, and we're in the repermitting process. This legislation is really important to us, and just as a brief background, the rules that apply to demolition landfills in Minnesota were adopted back in 1988, and those rules didn't even really address demolition landfills. So over the years between 88 and 2005, there was a lot of discussions about the rules and where we could go with that. And the bill does reference a guidance document that was implemented in 2005, and that guidance document really drove how demolition landfills in Minnesota were permitted from 2005 until the present day. I think what we've seen happen in the last year or so is like a little bit of a variance from that 2005 document, and it's become a little bit of a concern to the regulated community like ourselves. So what we see this legislation doing is taking away a little bit of that uncertainty by giving us approximate five-year period of time to address some of the changes and discussions that need to take place as we move forward. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for introducing this bill. And as I said, for our three counties, we serve a fairly large area with, you know, somewhat limited population, and the facilities that are in our area serve a really necessary purpose to the residents of our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Heenan. And Mr. Heenan, tell me, I mean, in your, from your perspective, one of the things that the environmental director in Roseau County is concerned about is that if the demo landfill were to close in Roseau, now from Hallock to International Falls, it's a long ways, you know, a couple hundred miles. But, I mean, do we have any concerns about what may happen with some of that demo landfill if we don't have a landfill that's a reasonable distance from a construction site?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, if you look at our regional area, we're really diverse in, you know, part of our counties are heavily agriculture areas, other parts of our areas become the forested part of the state. I think similar to Mr. Pawlowski's concerns, you know, especially in the areas that maybe are less populated and more backcountry roads, you know, some of that debris is going to end up in places that we don't want it to end up. You know, back in the 2000s when we were looking at the guidance document, one of the things that we really did want to address was getting that waste into locations where we at least knew where it was at and we could keep tabs on what was happening in the environment in and around that area. Even in our area today, with the fact that we have four facilities in our three counties, because we have five facilities, there's another facility that's owned and operated by the city of Fergus Falls, we still chase around the debris that ends up, you know, down a country road somewhere where they think they're not seen, and the debris gets thrown off. And, you know, if you think about demolition debris in general, you can't trace it back to anybody. You know, if somebody throws their garbage out there, I can go tear open a garbage bag and look in there and say, oh, John Smith put this here. But if I get out there and there's a pile of 2x4s and sheetrock and that type of thing, I can't trace that back to anybody. So it becomes either the township or the county's responsibility to clean that up, and who knows what else went out there with it. So I share Mr. Pawlowski's concerns.
And one more point I'd like to make, and that is, you know, the disposal of demolition debris is not free. I mean, what happens in your counties with regards to what you charge for your tipping fees or fees, and how much does the county actually subsidize the demo landfills?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's a really good question. In our county, We currently charge $9 a cubic yard plus the state tax that gets paid. Our costs right now in our facilities, which are online facilities, we do have groundwater monitoring associated with the sites, but our costs right now are probably closer to $14 a cubic yard. So we're subsidizing it by approximately $5 a cubic yard. And we do that to address the concern that you addressed yourself and just to, at $9 a cubic yard, we were from $8 last year to $9 this year, and we hear about that. You know, a dollar more a cubic yard, and we really hear from the customer that you raised your prices. So we do subsidize it by about $5 a cubic yard.
And Mr. Hayman, what you mentioned the state tax. What is that tax called, and how much is that?
The state tax is part of the solid waste management tax, and it's 60 cents a cubic yard. I'm not going to speak ill of that because it does go toward closed landfills and that type of thing, and we do have a couple of closed landfills in our region. So the tax is intended for a good thing. Whether it's the right amount, it's kind of low on a lot of demolition debris, but it's an additional 60 cents a cubic yard.
And Mr. Hayman, what can you give me an idea? Maybe Mr. Carlson can answer this too. What benefit do you derive from the 60 cents per cubic yard tax as counties and landfill operators?
Mr. Chairman, members, as it relates to demolition landfills, nothing. As I mentioned before, we do have three closed MSW landfills that are in our three-county area, and actually four. And all of them have had some degree of closed landfill dollars spent on either capping them or adding wet monitoring wells or those types of things. So there has been benefit to the MSW landfills that are in our area, and the taxes charged on MSW as well as demo debris.
And Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Lyon County would be in a similar position. We have a closed cell that is right next to our operating solid waste facility, and to wave the flag a little bit for the counties, you know, they operate a coordinated system where what happens in Lyon County, we receive solid waste from places like Rock County, the very south west corner of the state, and they bring their garbage to us, and then we ship our demolition debris back to them because they operate a demo landfill, and it's efficient for us. It is about $14 a ton, so the costs are very similar, but they try to be as environmentally protective and responsible as they can, so we don't have these facilities operating everywhere. We try to keep the costs as low as we can because we have seen a significant rise, not just in MSW illegal dumping, but in demolition debris illegal dumping as well, and that has a cost to everybody that we really try to avoid. So.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members? Representative Sundin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to Mr. Hannon, if I may.
Hannon.
Yep. Excuse me. Okay. Out of the four landfills that you referred to, are you taking any efforts to reduce the amount of material that's deposited there through recycling efforts or anything like that? I'm just wondering if carpeting would be filling up your landfill. I'm just wondering if we could get a report back on how many recycling efforts are going on there.
Mr. Hayman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's an excellent question. At our facilities right now, the items that we are not depositing in our landfill, and we are concrete and shingles. And what we've done in those areas is we actually give all of the customers that bring in sorted concrete and sorted shingles, we charge them half price, and we store the material and we grind it and reuse it. Obviously, we've all experienced with the use of ground concrete, and in our case, our county highway department is using our ground shingles in their. We used it on some filtering projects and that type of thing. So, yes, we are. Our county board has encouraged us every step of the way to look at more items. You mentioned carpeting. We're looking at ways to use that right now. We're not doing that, but we're looking at carpeting and that type of thing. That right now we get carpet if it's part of the if it's still attached to the floor by our permit, it can be disposed of in the landfill. The carpeting that we would be able to recycle is the stuff that's coming in rolled up, and we put it in what we call a bypass container Right now it's going to an MSW landfill, but we're looking into opportunities to recycle something like that too.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, and maybe this is a more of a legal question, but with this bill, with just extending the permit for 5 years automatically across the board, everybody, what if there is a transfer of ownership? What if there is a closure? What if there is a detection of water contamination? And what if there is something that is illegal that happens? And the last one, what if there is something illegal that happens? Does this bill then take away the ability of a consequence, maybe not a financial penalty, but a consequence of pulling a permit?
Mr. Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen. I took notes. I'll try and get them all in order. It's been my experience that trying to transfer ownership of one of these pieces of property is pretty difficult. The counties retain liability even when there is a transfer of ownership. So it's one of the reasons we're very concerned about making sure that we have operating permits for our facilities. So I don't think transfer is an issue, but as to the question of who's ultimately responsible, it's us. And so we watch that very closely. Just so that you know, the permits that are addressed here are only Class 1 demolition facilities, and so they, as this issue has been studied, they have the most sorting that goes on the front end, and it's the most inert material that we can put in that facility. Counties don't want to have groundwater contamination because we're responsible for it, and this only applies to facilities that are operating under the guidance issued in 2005. So right now, that's the best management practices that we have. As they develop new rules and new ways of handling waste streams, whether it's carpet or something else come online, those permits will be updated. But this just clears up a backlog pursuant to rule that they already do for expired permits and allows them to continue to operate. If they're going to expand, they've got different rules. This only relates to those that are just operating as they currently are.
Okay, good. Thank you. Other questions? Next, I'd like to have, in fact, I even wrote your name down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hayden, Mr. Carlson. Will this rule apply to the operators of private demolition landfills also? Do you know?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe, I'm not an attorney, but I believe the way it's written, it is intended to apply to all Class 1 facilities, whether they be publicly or privately owned and operated.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Just affirmatively, yes.
That answers yes. We've got somebody here from, who's this? The John Helmers.
Did he make it? I hadn't seen.
Okay.
I hadn't seen John come in yet. He was traveling in from Olmsted, and I don't know if he got in the bottleneck or not.
There's been some bottlenecks this morning. You know, get 2 inches of snow down here, and the whole world just kind of comes to an end. But the roads always, we jump up and down and celebrate. Whatever.
You're overestimating.
Anything else, members? Okay, so with that, I'd like to renew my motion to have House File 771 sent to the General Register. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl, can you limp on up to the testifier's table, please? Okay, we have before us House File 1116, and the intention here is to lay this bill over. It's my understanding that there may be a fiscal note, Representative Hansen, on this, a small one, so we'll have to take that up at a later date. So, with that, Representative Erdahl, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. This is a bill that deals with deputy registrar filing fees for DNR-related transactions. Other vehicles, ATVs, watercraft, off-road vehicles, off-highway motorcycles have a filing fee of $4.50 in renewals, and snowmobiles are $2, and they've been that way for 22 years, and all this does is try to bring parity with the others. So, in essence, that's what it does. For new ones, it's $7, and that pretty much is what the bill does. I will say that the Snowmobile Association has taken a neutral position on this.
Thank you. Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Minnesota Deputy Registrars are your license bureaus scattered across the state, and they help the local citizens with all of their registration and tab renewals and the like for both motor vehicle as well as DNR transactions. Deputy registrars are not subsidized in any which shape or form by the state. Rather, their only form of income are from these filing fees that are statutorily set. The balance of the funds that we collect, we dutifully remit to the state, in this case the DNR. As Representative Erdahl mentioned, these fees have not been increased in 22 years, and we feel that it's appropriate to have these fees to be similar to what the fees are currently for watercraft and ATV and the like. The amount of time involved is identical, regardless of whether it's an ATV or a snowmobile, and quite honestly, the need to bring parity to this is long overdue. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hurst, will the South St. Paul deputy registrars be happy with this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, yes, they will be. As a matter of fact, our legislative chair hails from South St. Paul, and she's in the audience right now. So, yes, that office, as well as all the other offices across the state, will benefit from this. Thank you.
Representative,
I think it's a good bill.
All Erdahl bills are good bills.
That's true.
We have one other person to testify on the list, Amanda Copen.
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, her testimony would only duplicate mine, so she's willing to forego her testimony.
Thank
this
you.
Time.
The deputy registrar provides a vital service. I know the Ziska family in my community that runs theirs, and with declining populations and so forth, it's... Yeah, this is a big deal for them. So thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Anything else? Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder if we should increase the fees on snowmobiles not made in Minnesota.
They don't make them outside.
I'm sure that you and Representative Sundin will have an amendment at some point. Thank you, gentlemen, for that. With that, the bill is laid over. next, Representative Drazkowski. As Representative Drazkowski and his testifiers are making their way to the table, members, we have House File 1557 before us. It's the intention of the chair to lay this bill over. I had an opportunity to visit yesterday with Representative Drazkowski about the bill. I think that... it's a bill that we really need to hear, and the story behind it is, as told to me by Representative Drazkowski, is somewhat compelling. So with that, Representative Drazkowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1557 provides that if
if an individual in Minnesota is has been proven in a court of law that they didn't violate a restoration order upon the government taking them to court and claiming they did, that the government can't turn around and place a deed restriction upon their deed. And members, that's exactly what happened in Wabasha County. I have with me today Vic and Peggy Ching from Plainview, and they'll talk a little bit soon about what happened. But just to go through it quickly, I got a call from Mr. Ching here, gosh, it's got to be 9 months or so ago, and he was in the middle of a discussion with the Wabasha Soil and Water District about a restoration order that they had provided to them, and was on the verge of, at that point, the county attorney taking him to court in order to force him to comply with the restoration order. There's disagreement in this case between Mr. and Mrs. Ching and the county over basically the border of their yard that borders an adjoining wetland. And they were told by the government, by here necessarily the technician at the Soil and Water Conservation District, that they had finally arrived at the point where the land was pushed out and pulled back to the point where it belonged according to their measurements. Mr. and Mrs. Ching then went and put huge riprap over the top of it to work to further protect that bank on there, and then doing that did not push the distance beyond what the dirt was toward the wetland. So it maintained the perimeter with the application of that riprap. The next day, I am told, the Soil and Water District came out again and measured again and said that they were in violation and that the distance was no longer correct. And so then they ended up going to court. The county took them to court. Mr. and Mrs. Ching were vindicated by a unanimous vote of a jury of their peers. And then subsequently, the county attorney, and I don't know, the DNR and others, filed a deed restriction on their deed because, according to the government, they were still not in compliance with the restoration order. So what this says, and obviously what seems to have happened here, is that the government made a mistake. The government doesn't want to admit that mistake and even comes to the point of putting a deed restriction on a deed. So, Mr. Chair, might be good to turn over to the testifiers.
Thank you. And Representative Graskowski, real quickly, and this might be a technical question. It is for me. A deed restriction, what is the net effect of a deed restriction?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the content of the deed restriction. You might ask Mr. Ching.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Ching and Mrs. Ching, thank you for being here. Would you both please identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your testimony? Thank you.
Good morning, committee members, committee chair. My name is Vic Ching. I live in the city of Plainview, Minnesota, in the county of Wabasha.
And I am Peggy Ching, also live in the city of Plainview, county of Wabasha.
So to give the committee some color on the situation, my wife and I purchased the property that's in question back in 2007. We chose to wait until 2014 to build on our property. When we started building on our property, I wanted to raise the elevation of our lot to create better drainage. And from the moment that the first truckload of fill came in, we were told that an anonymous phone call was received by the city of Plainview that I was filling in wetland. That was a total surprise to me, since none of the permits, none of the deed description had talked anything about a wetland situation at all on my property. Otherwise, I probably would not have purchased it. We went ahead and continue to build our house. In the meantime, I had received a cease and desist from the Wabasha SWCD, and we complied. We were working with the SWCD, and we were working with Bowser, Travis Hermanson at Bowser, to try to resolve the situation as best we could. 2 years later, still having black dirt on our lawn, we decided to just try to get this thing moved forward as much as we can. So I filed for a de minimis relief order, which allows me to only to impact a wetland no more than 2,000 square feet. So as part of that de minimis relief order, I was responsible to remove any fill beyond that 2,000 square feet and then put necessary mitigation in place to make sure that there was no erosion. We went ahead and hired Heartland Excavation out of St. Charles, Minnesota. They came, or the day of the excavation, Wabasha SWCD came out, marked the perimeter that we were supposed to excavate to stay within that 2,000 square feet. So that's the morning of excavation. Heartland Excavation went ahead and performed the excavation throughout the day. In the evening, after the excavation was completed, Wabasha SWC came out again to validate that we had removed enough fill. They gave us the go-ahead that enough fill was removed, because I told them, I said, I don't want to have any issues here and have any do-overs. We all understand it's a lot more costly to do to redo versus doing it right the first time. So we received that go-ahead. The next morning, Heartland Excavation started to place landscape fabric down on the slope and started to place riprap boulders on the slope. While they were starting to place those riprap boulders, Wabasha County SWCD came back out and reaffirmed that everything that they were doing was correct, and they left. So throughout the second day, Heartland Excavation placed the riprap boulders, and it only this project took 2 days. First day to excavate, second day to install the riprap boulders. At the end of the second day, Wabasha SWCD came back and tried to take some GPS readings, and their GPS was not working. So 2 days later, they came back and took the updated GPS readings, and that's when I was told that I was not in compliance with the 2,000 square feet de minimis relief.
Members, will you check to see who's got a device close to their mic? Sorry, technical problem.
Proceed. Give you the quick synopsis here. The net is Wabasha SWCD had full oversight over my project. They delineated the 2,000 square feet line. They came back and validated after the first day excavation that I was behind the 2,000 square feet line. But then after the project was done, all the riprap was placed on the slope. None of it was on the toe or beyond the toe to extend that 2,000 square feet. So everything was behind the line that they told us. They came back and said, oh, gee, you're not 2,000 square feet. You're 3,100 square feet. I said, how could I be beyond 2,000 square feet when you provided all the oversight to this project and we did not cheat, we did not put any additional fill back in, we did not put any riprap boulders beyond the toe of the slope? So I don't know how I could have not complied with the restoration order based on the oversight that Wabasha SWCD gave us. I'll let my wife speak about the situation.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and members.
Introduce yourself.
And I'm Peggy Chang.
Yep, we got that already. Thank you.
Our property, I see it as we bought all our permits. We had to pay to merge our two lots down at Wabasha County. At no time was there any indication. We're also the second to the last person to go into a development that's been quite established. Our neighbors have been there for a substantially long time. When they came, also to clarify, Plainview was sent out the first time and checked out our lot and told us that we were fine, we were within our property rights. And then it was later that Wabasha, whoever turned us in, also went to Wabasha County. Wabasha County came back and then started the process. Talking to the board also, we contacted the board that answers to the SWC. We were told they would come out and visit with us as a 5-member board to address our issues. No one showed up. They were later told that they were told not to come to our property or to talk to us by the county attorney. Yesterday we went to go visit the board again, and I addressed that as I don't understand how you can be charged with something, but they don't come out and research it or even check as to what's going on. So none of the board members have been to our property other than one did come with Steve, finally came and responded and looked and said that they could see the toe. Through the trial, they also, they do admit that they okayed the $2,000. It's kind of left out in the open as to no good answer as to why we aren't where we're supposed to be. My analogy kind of was if you go to a building supply store and I say I want a board cut to 34 inches and they cut it 32 inches and they say, well, we're sorry, but you have to pay for this board and then you buy another board too. So just kind of plain basic, it's been back and forth that yesterday they acknowledged too, I said we didn't go into this maliciously or trying to do anything wrong. We were just building our house. And if you look, the neighbors have their properties and stuff too. So, and along with on our testimony, one of the board members did, but at that time, too, the courts would not let him identify himself as being part of that board. And we talked about having Representative Drazkowski come, but the courts at that time, too, did not, he could not be Representative Steve Drazkowski. He could have only been a layperson. So there were some challenges that I have questions on as to how or why they were handled the way they were.
Thank you. Testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Mr. and Mrs. Ching have, I think, four documents that were passed around, including, I'm trying to remember exactly what they're all. Maybe Mr. Ching could go through what they are for you quickly.
Yep, thank you. Mr. Ching, go ahead.
Within your packet, you should have a letter from the foreman of Heartland Excavation, basically testifying to what Heartland Excavation did during the project. The second, another exhibit in there is the actual jury verdict that was filed with the Wabasha County after the trial. It was a unanimous not guilty that was handed down. The third exhibit is basically the affidavit that was used by the Minnesota DNR to file a deed restriction on my property. And to answer a prior question as to what's the ramification of the deed restriction, basically it restricts any future sale of my property to anybody else, because the future owner of my property will have to comply with the restoration order. I personally do not have to, but any future purchaser of my property would have to go back at that point in time and readdress the restoration order. So in a sense, it's a backdoor lien. And then the last exhibit is a memo that was given to me by the Wabasha SWCD when I posed the question to them as to why is the deed restriction being levied against my property. And if you read through the memo, it basically says that even though I was found not guilty at the trial, there was still no grounds that that the trial did not prove that I did not violate the wetland restoration order. Even though I received a not guilty verdict by six people, unanimous verdict, I was still being held basically guilty of the charge of violating a wetland restoration order.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski, please.
So I think one of the salient questions here, and maybe Mr. Ching can address it, would be what were the charges against him by the government? And as I think he told me before, they were charged with being out of compliance with the restoration order, and jury found him not guilty.
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, and I would add that, what government was it, just so we're all clear, that was finding him guilty?
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, it was the Wabasha County Attorney.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, for anyone up there, who is the most egregious form of government in this? Which one did most of the fact-finding and measuring and calculating? Which one was more at fault in bringing most of this evidence on up, you think? Was it the county or?
Well, I'll tell you the different.
Okay, to the testifiers.
Yep.
Go ahead. You're fine.
Excuse me.
We're not that far along.
I'll tell you the different roles the different players played. The Wabasha SWCD, they were responsible for basically providing the oversight, performing the GPS readings, and marking the 2,000 square feet delineation. The Wabasha County Attorney's Office, they were basically responsible for putting a gag order on this thing, as my wife mentioned. They put a gag order on the SWCD board to the point that they could not come out to look at my property. They could not speak to me at all to try to resolve the situation, even though they, as the LGA, they had responsibility over this administration, over this bill.
Representative Koresh.
This kind of goes back to our conversation the other day. Everybody thinks we're fine as long as it's handled by the local government unit. And this goes to show you that government overreach can go to any government, whether it's the federal, the state, or the local government. And the one thing that really concerns me is that a lot of this stuff was put together, and then this poor schmuck of a CO has to put his or her signature on it, the conservation officer, and it bothers me because the same thing they tried to do with the conservation officers when the feedlot enforcement shove it on them. Everybody gathers the stuff, takes it to the game warden, and he has to put his name on it. And this one, this wetland issue, is kind of what I don't think the CO is trained specifically to do all the measurements and the GPS and that, but then they still have to put their signature on the thing. So, It does bother me that there wasn't protection from the county commissioners or the county boards or some people stepping up to say enough is enough. It shouldn't go any further on up the chain and have somebody have to put their signature to something that they didn't have a part of, maybe. But go ahead.
May I add something to that?
Mr. Chang, go ahead. Proceed.
With regards to the deed restriction, the moment I received news that a deed restriction was being placed on my property, I called the DNR enforcement officer, Julie Seen, and I asked her, who told you to place the deed restriction on my property? Because I said, it's my assumption that you're just not running out there placing deed restrictions on people's properties willy-nilly. She said, I was told by, it was an outcome of a meeting between Bowser, Travis Grummondson, the Wabasha SWCD, Terry Peters, the Wabasha County Assistant Attorney, and John Rice, and her captain, Corey Palmer. So those four people met, made a decision, and then told Julie Seems to take this action.
Representative Cornish.
And then to get back to the problem, here we have one person having to put their signature on a decision that they had really nothing to do with, and then the conservation officer gets the reputation of the big mean agent of the government that comes out there. So let them issue their own darn orders.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. And I would say in this case here, based on what I know at this point, the local CO should not be doing this. If somebody above that person is making that decision, a captain someplace or somebody in St. Paul, they should be putting their name on that order, not the local CO. Somebody had managed to send me a column about that was in the Star Tribune yesterday. Ironically, it just happens to focus on conservation officers in northwest Minnesota. And one of the things that was mentioned in there is the shortage and so forth that they perceive to have. And one of the reasons that they don't have enough time to do things is because they're out enforcing wetland orders. This is really frustrating for the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
If I could, throughout this process, as I talked to the Soil and Water District and sent them emails and so forth, and talk to Bowser, the question I kept bringing forward is, why can't you work with these folks in order to figure out how they can comply with the law instead of forcing a situation and trying to make them fail? And that seemed to be the direction that all along that this was being pushed. Instead of government helping them figure out how they're going to comply and be successful, it seemed to be working in the other direction. And so, Representative Cornish, I think you're right. In this situation, fortunately, I think the Chings did sort out exactly where that came from and realize it wasn't the CEO in that case. But I can see where in many cases, if something like this happened, it could be construed that that was it.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Ching, for coming down. I'm sorry that you went through what you went through. It's tough to hear these stories, but I'm glad we're here to try to do something about this. What's been sticking with me, and please clarify this for me, if you will. What I'm hearing is an anonymous letter, anonymous phone calls, poor findings, justified in court, smacked down a second time after you've been found not guilty. My question to you, and I don't know if I missed this, were you ever at any time able to face your anonymous accusers? Because this is a trend that I'm seeing that is starting to really get under my skin.
To the Chin family.
The answer is no. And when the first time the anonymous phone call was made to the city of Plainview, I called them up. I said, you know, I understand the bill. I'm a naturalized citizen. I understand my rights, because I had to learn them. I called up the city of Plainview and I asked them, I'm supposed to be able to face my accuser. Mm-hmm. And the answer I received was, well, I'm sorry, but there's a thing called the Whistleblower Act that they're protected behind. So my reaction is, so you're elevating my situation here to be the same as me being a crack dealer or something like that. But in this whole time, I've never been able to face that anonymous accuser. I've never been able to sit down, talk to Director Jarvis at Bowser when I was trying to appeal the wetland designation. I was never able to sit down with the county attorney because they said I was represented by an attorney, so I could not speak to them directly. I called the assistant county attorney before the trial process started when I received the order threatening that action was going to be taken. I said, let's talk about this. Let's just talk about this. And the reaction I got from the assistant county attorney was, no, I think we're pretty comfortable with the facts. I said, well, maybe you are from your side of the story. Maybe you'd want to hear it from my side of the story, too. And it came out at the trial, and I was found not guilty. And then they still go ahead and slap me in the back with a deed restriction. So is this justice?
Representative Neuberger.
Mr. Chair, just one other point I think that's salient, and maybe Mr. and Mrs. Ching can outline it, but I don't remember the numbers, but Mr. Ching shared with me at one point what the total costs
to
their family were in defending themselves, and also the total number of hours, which would not be included in those costs, that the Ching family spent away from work, et cetera.
Mr. Ching, please.
Throughout this whole process, in terms of engaging experts, engaging attorneys, I spent over $6,000 just in professional fees. That's not counting the additional $5,000+ that I had to spend on the excavation and on the riprap removal. So we finally gave up trying to fight whether or not this was a wetland, even though there is a city storm drain that dumps into the drainage ditch between myself and another farmer less than 50 feet away. I said, how can that be a natural occurring wetland when there is a city storm drain dumping water into that waterway? We gave up fighting it. Said, we need a lawn. So I said, fine, we will try to comply, and that's when I filed for the de minimis relief. And so we've tried to do everything right to the letter of the law. we want to leave a good world for our family. So we're trying to do the right thing. We try to hire professionals to do the work. We did it right. We put two layers of fabric down, and even that was contested by the assistant county attorney. Why did you put two layers of fabric down, you know, on the slope underneath the riprap? Well, to make sure that the thing doesn't erode. So I paid extra cost to do it the right way. I didn't have to put riprap down. And now they come back and say, well, you're out of compliance by another 1,100 square feet, and oh, you can fix it by buying more credits. And with regards to how many man hours or how many hours my wife and I have put into this thing, it can easily be in the hundreds of hours. Trying to research this thing, trying to talk to our attorney, having personal conversations and heated discussions as to what we should be doing with this thing. And I finally said, you know, I'm an American citizen. I can choose how I want to spend my money. Damn if the state is not telling me how to spend my money. Because they were telling me, just go buy the credits and be done with it. No, if I have to spend the money, I'm going to fight for what's right. And I think I was right doing what I did and the way I've approached it. And now the state is tying my hands in terms of what I can do with my property.
Thank you. And members, I'm a fire chief. Oh, okay.
May I just,
Mrs. Ching, yes.
Really quick. We live in a small community of a little over 3,000 people, so I guess that's part of it. We've had the local grocery store in town for many years, and it's just a really nice community. It's, and in the whole scope of the world, when we're looking at the money spent from the government perspective, our perspective, we're talking about a puddle, and I'm not saying that any wetlands aren't important, but to be handled in the correct way. I did have an incident, too. I also teach a release time class with kids. And in the midst of this, we had a meeting with a bunch of the people. And the day before, I had found out that one of my release time kids had gone to a homeless shelter. They'd been living in their car. And looking at the people coming constantly to do soil samples and different vegetation things and stuff, all I could think of was, for the amount of space that we're talking about here, that money could have spent probably much better to help that family out or someone else out.
I couldn't agree more. And members, I'm not a math teacher. I spent 35 years teaching. We're talking about roughly 1,100 feet here. 30 by 40. 30 feet by 40 feet. That's about the size of this lower level of the hearing room. Representative Lewick. And then Hanson and Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, I was doing the same math, and we need to understand that we're what these fine folks were put through literally was over a postage stamp piece of ground. Just out of curiosity, sake, do you have any idea what the wetland credits that was proposed would have cost? If you have a ballpark?
The original area of impact before the excavation started, I was told that I was impacting the wetland by 3,200 square feet. And at that time, I was told that the cost would have been $20,000.
Thank you. And maybe more?
Yes. Well, I just want to make you realize the numbers here. The original area of impact was 3,200 square feet. After the excavation and after multiple truckloads of fill was removed, the SWCD came back and told me my area of impact was 3,100 square feet. So after all the truckloads of fill was removed, the SWCD claimed in the trial that I only took up 100 square feet of fill. Okay? Why do you think the jury came back with a not guilty verdict?
Okay. Well, thank you.
Quick follow-up, quickly, Mr. Chair.
Very quick.
Just really plain and simple. Quite often, and we've seen this up in my area where we've got a lot of wetlands, this wetland banking thing, becomes a rush for certain people in a legal business to make a lot of money really quick, and they leave carnage and wreckage right behind them in circumstances like this. When you start talking about somebody trying to build a home and live in it, it is just an example of, I mean, literally, this wetland thing can be used as a local, literally warfare on people within the community, and we are enabling that as a government, and we need to get that straightened out. I mean, we're talking about a postage stamp here that's cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and had they just given in to intimidation, another $20,000 check, what, to make everybody happy? I mean, this is not an isolated case, and I thank you, Representative Draskowski, for bringing this before us and the testifiers, because I've seen too much of this over the years.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Draskowski had a question on the bill, on the practical. So the bill would make sure that Chings would not be having double jeopardy, essentially, that because the court has ruled that their order would be lifted by statute. And I want to check that there's no appeal or there's nothing else under litigation right now.
To the testifiers.
At this point in time, I have two choices. The Wabasha SWCD has basically said they're not going to take any action with regards to the deed restriction. So I have two choices. I can go buy credits or I can sue the state. Okay? I'm to the point where I'm going to take the latter if nothing gets done.
Mr. Chair, and that's fine. I'm just trying to see if there's something going on right now with, if there's current action going on. So there's no current litigation right now. Okay. And Representative Draskowski, the second part of it would be to provide the same relief for anybody else in this situation. And do we know if there's anybody else in this situation?
Representative Draskowski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I have no idea.
And then
Representative Hansen.
Finally, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ching, your testimony is very compelling. And it sounds, and looking at this, it's very, very compelling. I'm trying to get an idea of the kind of the chain of command following up on Representative Cornish's question. So is your property in the city of Plainview, or is it in the township adjoining the city?
Mr. Ching.
It is in the city of Plainview.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, so has the city government been involved at all in terms of, I'm wondering how the city is acting on this.
Mr. Ching.
The city's involvement was strictly at the beginning when the initial anonymous phone call was made to the city. They came out, looked at the property, looked at what was being done. They walked away and said, you're within your property lines to do what you want to do.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then it went to the Soil and Water Conservation District acting, Soil and Water Conservation District staff coming out. They're managed by an elected board, and then the appeal there would be to Bowser. And you mentioned Bowser names, and then, as Representative Cornish mentioned, then DNR got involved. Is that kind of the correct chronology?
Mr. Ching.
Yes, that's in essence the trail that happened. Wabasha SWCD came out, made the initial designation that it could be a wetland. A TEP panel was then convened with multiple people, and that's where my wife referenced to six different people from different organizations coming out multiple times. And then when I tried to appeal it, I appealed it to Bowser, and I interacted with Travis Gormanson. I asked to speak with Director Jasky at the time. I was never allowed to speak with Director Jasky, and because my concern at that point in time was basically, how can I be appealing a decision back to the same organization? Shouldn't I be able to appeal it to a third party? And I said, and they said, no, this is the way it works. I said, okay, fine. I'll trust that you'll do the right thing. And then when it came back that the repeal was rejected, I then tried to negotiate with Terry Peters out of the SWCD. Travis Gummerson tried to act as a go-between, and nothing happened.
Thank you.
And quickly, and Mr. Chair, is there anyone from the Wabasha SWCD or Bowser here or DNR to testify?
They're nodding. Yep. Come on down. Quickly, please. Members, you need to plan. We'll probably be coming back this evening.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for record, my name is David Wirens. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And if Rep. Hansen, if you could repeat your question.
Jim Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's important, and I realize this is going to take time, but I want to hear Bowser's side of the story. I want to hear what happened and why this happened.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, our involvement in the case is to serve on the tech evaluation panel that initially has looked at the site on several occasions. It's also to manage the appeals process that's been referred to as well, as was the restoration order was appealed by Mr. Ching. And I say furthermore, the reference that Mr. Ching makes reached out to Director Jassy was forwarded to me, and I did speak at some length with Mr. Ching over a period of a few months on this as well. But I need to back up a few steps on kind of what in fact has occurred here. Is that certainly from the work that I did when Mr. Ching approached me, because the primary matter, I'm not generally involved with these cases on a day-by-day basis. But when I received his phone call, that was a complaint of how things were going in this. It was my duty to kind of follow up and do some investigating. Some of the issues that are, I think, in play in this is important to keep in mind as well that it does seem as though Mr. Ching did start in the right place and talking with the City of Plainview. Perhaps he got some bad advice there that kind of started him down a certain path. That's not for me to say so much, but that's certainly one observation that could in fact be made. But their job is not to oversee the wetland regulations either, so they may not know necessarily what they're looking at as well, to cut them a little bit of slack in that also. But it's important to recognize Mr. Ching had 2 years after the restoration order was issued before the single forward as well. There was 2 years of time to respond to the restoration order and to take some action. And in fact, based upon what I was told by both our regional staff as well as by SBCD, in fact, during that 2 year time period, the amount of fill actually increased due to the erosion of the site because it was unstable, stuff with black dirt, as was referenced as well. So the actual area of fill actually increased over time from what was initially, in fact, the case. The appeal was, in fact, that was brought to Bowser was, in fact, denied to appeal the restoration order. There were a few charges that were requests that were made in that order. One was that the wetlands were incidental. They were not natural wetlands. There was no evidence to that case, so that part was set aside. And then the other fact is that the de minimis that's in the law, the 2,000 square feet, was in fact exceeded. The other observation thing that I would make in my investigation is that, and the SBCD should be here to discuss some of this, but again, we're not a court of law here to actually rehear some of the facts. But what I would say is that from SBCD's perspective, when they were involved with this particular case, the facts that I have is true is that that when the fill was removed, it was within the 2,000 square feet. However, the point where things seemed to kind of change is when the riprap was placed in. That's kind of where the evidence that I've heard and from the documentation from SBCD is that the riprap actually exceeded the 2,000 square feet. And that's where the riprap rock is fill. Make no bones about it. That is fill in a wetland area that needs to be regulated under the wetland conservation. That's what the law, in fact, provides for as well. In part of my conversation with Mr. Ching, we did talk about what options it might be to resolve this. Obviously, at this point, he was not willing to go back in and re-excavate and kind of move that line. They have other implications. We did talk about alternative options in terms of, buying the wetland credits. He was talking about buying 3,000 square feet of wetland credits. Our conversation was, what if an option B is only paying for the overage? which is not what the law provides for, but once you're in an enforcement setting, you have more flexibility trying to negotiate. Even that was not acceptable to Mr. Ching in our conversations. Just trying to find kind of what we do to resolve this. So we're not here today in discussing the details of this particular issue. So, you know, from our perspective, you know, my goal was to understand the facts as best I could and talking to the SUCD. I did talk to the excavator as well, talking to our staff, what that involved with that. And I think, again, the bottom line is that the two facts that are relevant here is that, you know, there were 2 years to resolve before it got to this particular point. No action was taken. And, again, the issue about the fill is that the additional riprap does count as fill, and that is what appears to have exceeded 2,000 square feet and why the restoration order has not been complied with.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to bring it to the bill, if this bill passes into law, what changes from Bowser's perspective?
Mr. Wyers. Well, Mr. Chair, and this is a question for DNR to respond as well, but I'll give some response, and if there's more for DNR, because this speaks directly to their authority, and it goes beyond the Wetland Conservation Act. I mean, this applies to all authority of the Department of Natural Resources to put liens on property for an array of programs and for violations. And, you know, one thing to be mindful of, this is a regulatory program. People violate it, sometimes knowingly, sometimes not knowingly. But the bottom line is that there needs to be consequences when the law is not followed. And this is one means to try and get that, in fact, to be the case. The concern that we would have is it would reduce the effectiveness of a tool that we use when we are dealing with situations where we cannot reach an agreement with the landowner on how to resolve a violation before it gets to court.
Jeff Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it appears the law to me is this would be a remedy after it's been to court rather than before it gets to court.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, that is certainly true. However, when we're working on enforcement cases with our staff, with DNR, with local governments, we certainly are aware of the entire range of the law and how that is going to work. And we do evaluate all potential outcomes as part of the analysis of how to proceed on any one given case. And this new provision will have a bearing on that decision-making process.
Wardenius, Representative Wardenius.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Brian Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. What I'm hearing today bothers me. One thing we have what's called the Constitution, our civil rights. And one thing, if we feel we've been wronged, that we can go to is the courts. Going through the information that Mr. Vick provided, especially with this memo that was dated January 20th of 2017, talking about this order. What's interesting in this memo, it does not even talk about the fact that the courts and a jury of his peers found him not guilty. That means that the accusations by the county and the Board of Law, Soil and Water Conservation District Board, were wrong. They did not prove their case. It really bothers me that Bowser is superseding our court system. That is not how things are supposed to work. Bowser and these boards are not the final say. It's our court system, and the courts have spoken. It really concerns me with what's going on, so I'm going to leave it at that. One other thing, Mr. Vick talked about the Whistleblower Act. I think that county attorney might need to go back and check on it, because that is just for federal employees whistleblowing against the federal government.
Thank you. Mr. Irons, I have a comment. You, in your testimony, you said that you thought that maybe Mr. Ching got some bad advice from the city and that you would cut the city some slack. Tell me, what slack have you cut the Ching family?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to find alternative ways to resolve this violation as well. The conversation we had of replacing just the overage amount, the 1,000 square feet roughly, that is not what the law provides for. That is a that'd be a remedy that is available only once you enforce the setting, and that is a remedy from it. As Mr. Ching was informed earlier on, is that once you hit a violation, the replacement can be up to a 4-to-1 ratio. And the sense that I had as a way to try and address the circumstance is that a 1-to-1 ratio of only the 1,000 square feet instead of, because his equivalent of $20,000 is based upon 3,000 square feet times 4, so is the amount what he would have to replace otherwise. What's suggested to try to address the circumstances, Highness, is let's look at the 1,000 square feet at a 1-to-1 ratio, and that even itself is not acceptable. That was an offer that was laid on the table that I would have had conversation with the SBCD. Again, at Bowser, we can't direct the SBCD to take that action or the DNR that holds the trust force in order, but we certainly, if there is some verbal agreement on that as a solution, I would have engaged in the opportunity to talk to them about is this a viable option from their perspective as well.
Mr. Irons, Director Irons, I'm going to ask you to submit to this committee all your documents that you have related to this, and I want a detailed spreadsheet how much money your agency has spent going after these decent people. And I want that as soon as possible. Representative Cornish.
Real quickly, I think, give you some perspective, I think some of this happened. I was a conservation officer when the WEOs were formed. That's what they call the Wetlands Enforcement Officer. There was something like six of them that would be what Julie thinks or what this officer here is. And the thinking was at the time that if they turned these decisions down to prosecutors sign these orders to the local level might be afraid to do it. So give it to somebody that's more untouchable. And nothing against COs, but they were kind of stuck into this statewide agent for decisions that are made. The COs, I think, are probably trained in the legality of it and how to issue these things and investigate like that, but not to the point where you get GPS and the depth of the fill and the placing of the riprap and the screen and all these things. So all these things comes to them and they're stuck with putting their name on it. So as soon as the WACA Act and certain legislation that was enacted, all we have to do is go back in, force the decision lower down. If it takes the peace officer, then change it so that the other officer can do it or a local official on a civil citation or something like this. But I think we got to get the conservation officers back in the woods and where they belong and where their mission statement really started. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
James, I need to expedite this a little bit. We've got a timeline of 10 o'clock that we'd like to try and meet. I appreciate that. I see... Okay, you're not going to testify, DNR? Okay, good. All right, so closing statements here.
May I just make a comment?
You may.
Unto a law not followed, I do totally agree there are consequences, but in my mind, we followed and tried to comply with that, and so to get this left on us afterwards.
We have some proof of that.
On the two-year, this has not been, as a mom and as a grandma, this is not a pleasant two-year. It's not us that wanted to stretch it out to the 2 years. I had a son graduate at the beginning of this, and I have grandkids, too, that for 2 years I've had mud. So.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Very much. Mr. Ching, final comment.
This is my first time I've had to actually see or meet Mr. Wyrons. Three comments on what was said. In my past conversations, I don't recall whether or not I was with Mr. Wyrens or Mr. Grumman. It was a literally slap on my face when I was told, everybody speeds, but only a few people get caught. With regards to when I said, how could I have violated a wetland when I had no clue it was a wetland? Point number one. Point number two, the point about riprap being fill, I believe Representative Draskowski can testify to the fact when he came to my property, he saw every piece of riprap on the slope and not beyond the toe or on the toe. So we did not stretch 2,000 square feet. Point number three, I appreciate the offer by Bowser to allow me to only pay for restoration of 1,100 square feet. But you know what? It wasn't my fault if I really did violate the additional 1,100 square feet. There is no accountability in this whole process
by the Minnesota state government. So they want me to pay for somebody else's mistake. Is that right? Thank you.
Thank you. President Drazkowski, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, I just make one appeal to you. Your request to Mr. Warrens might not be quite a wide enough net. You asked for his agency to bring forward what their expenses were. You may want to include the Solon Water District, the DNR, the city, or any other units of government that might be involved with it.
I don't have any jurisdiction over the city and the Solon Water Conservation District, but I do over DNR, and I want the same information from them.
And I bet they would be willing and able to ask the Soil Water District for theirs. But, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, members, for your compelling discussion. This is an important issue, and I think maybe an indication of an area of law that we need to take a look at in protecting people from government who, in this case, won't admit that they made a mistake.
And they want more money.
And they want more money from you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, the bill's right over.
All right, next up, members, we have House File 1673.
Okay, members, House File 1673, I'd like to move to re-refer to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Nope.
I got the amendment. That's what I wanted to hear. Okay? Sorry about that.
Good bill.
A6, all right. So I'd like to move the A6 amendment. Okay? Can we re-roll the tape here? The A6 amendment, to get the bill in the shape that I would like, all those in favor of the A6, say aye, please.
Yeah,
aye. Aye. Those opposed? Okay. The amendment is adopted. So, members, the A6 amendment deletes a number of sections in the bill. Representative Sundin, I'm going to test you to see if you can find a section that I think you really like, okay?
Oh, boy.
So, as you go through the bill on page 8, we're deleting section 16. And then on page 10, we're deleting section 18. And on page 11, section 21, and that would go through line 12.7. And then on page 17, section 36. And then on page 18, section 38. And then on page 18, section 40. And then on page, you can see the insert going, subdivision 2 in the bill. And then on page 19, section 41. And page 20, section 45. The turtles are really getting cut here today. Page 20, line 25, making that deletion. And then the page 20, line 26, and line 28. And then the repealers. Sundin, I think actually you find the one in the repealers that I think that you will like. Okay? It might be the the very first one on page 1R at the top.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm still stuck on crayfish and frogs.
So anyway, okay. So with that, we have a testifier here. This is Amber Elling, who is the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Would you please identify yourself for the record and walk through the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Amber Ellering. I work for Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Government Affairs. I'm here to present the DNR's policy and technical provisions. The objective of this bill is to clarify DNR's responsibilities, streamline our work, in some cases provide consistency with other state statutes, and in other cases modernize DNR's business processes for our customers. These are cleanup type provisions brought forward by DNR divisions that they've noticed in the course of their work would allow for better service for our customers and more success in our mission. Okay, so section by section. Section 1 allows the DNR to use in-house attorneys or outside counsel for land transactions and severed mineral interest forfeiture actions. This would expedite land acquisition, exchange, and sales. Our Division of Lands and Minerals already has many attorneys, and this would allow us to the flexibility to use them to expedite these processes. Section 2 sets a minimum of 12 years of age to take the off-highway motorcycle safety training. Section 3, also with regard to the off-highway motorcycle safety training, establishes standards for setting fees. Section 4 allows demolition as part of asset preservation activities. This is consistent with Chapter 16 on asset preservation. On to the next page, Section 5. This adds an annual report on priorities for asset preservation from DNR to Minnesota Management and Budget. Section 6, 7, 8, and 9 simplify hiring and recruitment of Minnesota Naturalist Corps positions within our Division of Parks and Trails. These are learning positions similar to internships, and this would help us maintain that program. Section 9 specifically reduces the unemployment costs for these entry-level learning positions. Section 10 relates to bait dealers and allows those dealers who only sell bait to be used in a water body it was harvested from to continue to do so, but would add permit specifications to ensure that this happens. This is to reduce the risk of spread of invasive species. On to page 6, section 11. It is similarly needed for aquatic invasive species risk reduction and allows permits for commercial fishing to specify that DNR may remove tags from decontaminated fishing gear. So it's to modernize, to keep up with the practices of decontamination, which may be effective in some cases at reducing spread. Section 12 clarifies DNR authority to list prohibited or regulated invasive species at the genus or subspecies level. This is the functional classification for some of these animals, and that's why we're bringing this forward. Section 13 allows trash haulers to transport aquatic plants for disposal. We restrict transport of invasive species, but there is a conservation benefit to allowing transport for disposal. Section 14 allows DNR to permit the tagging and release of invasive carp by the agency into waters they were removed from for research purposes. The idea is if you study how they move, we can manage carp better. Section 15 relates to the designation of state water trails and brings us up to speed with the current practices and names of certain water bodies. It also establishes criteria and a process for designating state water trails and is clarifying in that way. Section 16 was removed from the bill as per the A6 amendment. Section 17 clarifies personal flotation device requirements such that they are in line with federal requirements. Section 18 was removed as per A6. Section 19 prohibits use of lights on a watercraft that interfere with visibility of navigation lights. This is needed due to new boat lights on the market and is supported by law enforcement cooperators and is a boat and water safety priority. Many of the following sections deal with legal duties that DNR can take over from the Attorney General's office. These are really very minor legal duties so that we don't need to involve the Attorney General's office. Removing their involvement will reduce delays and increase efficiency, and this package is being recommended by our attorneys at DNR. Many of them are so minor they deal with forms. I'll highlight those for you. Our attorneys are able to ensure we are using valid forms from a legal perspective. Section 20 removes Attorney General approval requirements for auxiliary forest contracts. Section 22 removes Attorney General approval from purchase agreements for tree seedlings. 23 removes Attorney General approval from the timber trespass settlement process. Section 24 removes Attorney General approval from timber sale bond requirement forms. Now that's a form. Section 25 removes Attorney General approval requirements for timber auction bid guarantee forms. Section 26 removes Attorney General approval for timber permit to cut forms. Section 27 removes Attorney General approval for security deposit and other timber sales forms. 28 removes Attorney General approval for timber sale agreement forms. 29 and 30 remove Attorney General office from the land exchange process, thereby increasing efficiency. Section 31 updates definition of protected wild animals. Section 32 updates definitions for rough fish. Section 33 updates definitions for small game to include some weasels. Section 34 updates definitions for unprotected birds. Section 35 updates definitions for unprotected wild animals. Section 36 is not included in the bill as per the A6 amendment. Section 37 removes Attorney General's office approval from reciprocal agreements with other game and fish authorities. These are used to share information about violations and are a useful enforcement instrument. Section 38 is removed from the bill as per the A6 amendment. Section 39 updates definitions related to which animals an owner or occupant of a building may take when those animals do damage, and expands that definition. Section 40 is removed as per the A6 amendment, as is Section 41 following it. Section 42 simplifies mussel shell harvest requirements. This reduces the complexity of many pages of rule in the repealer and enhances conservation outcomes. Section 43 transfers legal approval for designating low watermark in-house from the Attorney General's office. Section 44 establishes that portages that have existed for greater than 15 years on canoe routes will continue to be open to the public. Section 45 is eliminated as per the A6 amendment. Section 46 is repealer language, and you can refer to the appendix that follows. Chapter 84.025 is stricken as per the A6 amendment. The second provision you see there, related to procurement law, repeals outdated direction on grants processing that conflicts with Department of Admin statutes, which direct all agencies in grants processing. The next provision.
Ms. Elling, I think members had some time to read through these things in the appendix. Is that all right? If you, Representative Hansen.
Okay.
Move the bill along real quickly. I'd like to get to the. Yep, and then we've got the. We got a question and we have an amendment to. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, reading through the extremely complicated bill here and everything else, I do have one question on the navigation lights on page 11, right at the top. Right now, under the wording in the law, we'd be outlawing some of the lights, for instance, blue lights that are on many popular pontoon boats and things along the flooring or in the drink holders or even on the dash, the way I'm reading this. So I have a concern with the many existing boat owners that already have these lights on, particularly pontoons, but other boats too. The wording seems to be very general on this, and I think we could clean that up a little bit because actually many dash lights are blue too.
Thank you, Ms. Ellen.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to call technical support on boat and water safety.
Sure.
Expertise from our boat and water safety program manager, Stan Linnell.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Stan Linnell, State Boating Law Administrator with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair and representatives, the clarification would be this would be lights visible to the exterior, so dash lights and cup holder lights wouldn't be of a concern. The U.S. Coast Guard has raised this concern that the decorative lights that are becoming more popular can be misinterpreted as law enforcement lights. If lights underneath the deck of a pontoon boat mixed with waves can be seen as flashing blue lights at a distance. So both the National State or National Association of State Boating Law Administrators and the Coast Guard has raised various concerns related to excessive blue lights.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification. As long as it's going to be interpreted that way, I think we'll be fine.
Thank you. I just want to make sure we're not increasing the workload for our COs.
I don't know that I can address that. I don't. I mean, there's already we already work to enforce excessive lightings because lightings already cannot interfere with navigation lights, but it's not clearly stated in law. So this makes provision for law enforcement that allows
the lights.
Thank you.
Representative Joaquin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. When I was listening to
speaking to the microphone, please.
Thanks. When I was listening to the things that you were taking from the Attorney General's office, I didn't hear, but I just wanted to make sure that I got it right, that there is a form for easements that the Attorney General reviews. I did not hear that you were taking over that responsibility. Was that correct?
Ms. Ellen.
I'm not 100% sure on that. I did not mention easements, but I could get that clarification from our lands and minerals.
Commissioner Meyer coming
staff.
Down.
I do not believe that is in the bill, but I want to be sure.
Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan Damon, Land Acquisition Legal Services Section Manager in the Division of Lands and Minerals. I do not believe that there's a provision about easements in this bill. I was actually here to testify on other sections if needed, but I can review that and let you know if there's a concern.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. There, you have on 1919 a harvesting mussel shell, and in the repealer you have a season for mussel shells. What's the difference between what you're repealing and what you're putting in law?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to request technical assistance from our Division of Ecological and Water Resources Manager on this. It is quite complex, but as I stated, it's a simplification in law. But I am not a mussels expert. My background is in forestry.
Thank you. Identify yourself, please.
Chair, representatives, I'm Ann Pierce. I'm section manager with the Department of Natural Resources. What the change in statute is allowing us to do is take the rules and condense them into a much more simplified and understandable law. The rules were designed as we went through the years, and pieces were added to them, and as we reviewed them, we realized that we could condense that into a very simple, just straightforward piece that could be in statute. So some, it is redundant, but it's simplified and clarified, and so in that way.
Dr. Joaquin, yes?
Thank you. I just didn't see the changes in words. I mean, you look at it quickly, and it looks like pretty much the same wording.
Thank you.
And
yep. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. What we did was take the wording out that really said what we needed to have said, so some of it probably is exactly the same wording, but I can look at that and clarify it a little bit more and make sure that I understand what you're seeing in there.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin, yes.
That's it.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, what are you calling a mussel here?
The testifiers.
Representative and Chair, mussels are defined as, there's a specific definition of mussels, and so those are clams, basically, is your common clam that you would, but endangered clams.
Representative Cornish.
And then it says, live mussels may not be harvested, and then it goes and talks about how you can harvest them. So it seems kind of confusing. It starts out, live mussels may not be harvested, and then it talks about mussel shells must be harvested. Are you saying that the person can't take clams anymore? Walk through the river, pick up clams, and take them home and fry them like we always have?
Do the test fires.
So, Chair and Representative, currently in rule, clams, live clams cannot be harvested, but the shells can. So a dead clam that has opened up and the shells are there, you can harvest shells.
So if we're walking the river, take some clams and put them in a gunny sack, go up, dice them up, put lemon and butter in them, fry them up, we're illegal. I mean, you can't harvest clams?
To the test fires.
Chair and Representative, right now you would need a permit to harvest those clams if they're being
pursued. I'm crying.
I screwed up my whole diet here.
Yeah.
I got a couple other questions.
Yes, proceed.
If we're off clams for a while.
We can do frogs, turtles, clams, you pick.
Why did you add salamanders, lizards, weasels? Back here there's a place where you add the add them into small game or something. Why did you add salamanders in there and those other things? Are they afforded any more protection there? Or 18.12 on page 18.
To the testifiers.
Chair, Representative. So the list of species that were added to protected animals was added partly because we are seeing decline in those animals, and to make sure that in those situations that we have the ability to monitor and provide permits or open season for those because we're seeing decline. So it's kind of in an attempt to conserve those and prevent them from further declining and having to be protected.
The couple follow-up here then. So kids can still pick up salamanders and take them home if you're not putting them on any threatened or endangered list.
Chair, Representative, no, they're not on any endangered or threatened list.
And then the provision you had in here for turtles, possession of the number of turtles, is that going to affect in any way the turtle race up in Nisswa we go take the kids to every year? It says you can only have three of them. What if I want five turtles in my lane?
To the test fires.
Mr. Chair, members, which section can you clarify that you're looking at?
Well, it's the 17.12. On page 17, a resident under 18 may take and possess up to three individuals of any species. So you can't have over three turtles for anything?
Representative, Mr. Chair, that was removed from the bill as per the A6 amendment.
Oh.
Okay, sounds good.
Oh, good.
I'll make the word.
Thank you. Representative, anything else? Yep, and then we got the amendment. The 8-2. Thank you, Representative Heintzman, for the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get a call on Karen Opus. I probably pronounced that name wrong. She can state her name for the record and fix it. And she can walk us through the amendment quickly.
You want to move it while she's doing that?
Yes, I would move the A2 amendment.
A2 amendment has been moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment's adopted.
Committee Chair, thank you so much. My name is Karen Umphus. I'm with the Amateur Riders and Motorcycle Association. We operate as District 23 of the American Motorcyclist Association, which is a national program. Walking through the amendment for A2.
Proceed, please.
Basically two things. The first is on line 16, page 1. There's a trail that crosses the boundary between Minnesota and Wisconsin. The trail's been there for over 20 years, but Wisconsin just put in a statewide off-highway motorcycle program. This will allow people to ride that trail without being in violation if they only have a Minnesota or a Wisconsin registration. Page 20, line 1, as well as page 3, line 13, are information about changing the off-highway ATV and off-highway motorcycle safety programs. And before I want to give you a little bit of background on that, I am a dirt bike safety instructor. This is a curriculum for the Motorcycle Safety and Foundation. Nationwide, there are approximately 23 states that require ATV and motorcycle training, and over half of those use the Motorcycle Safety Foundation and the ATV Safety Institute as their only form of training. These nationwide programs have trained thousands of children, and they start at age 6. The program is a success, and we want to model our legislation on their program. The reason for the change is not because there's any issues with kids getting motorcycle training or that we have fatalities or injuries, but the issue is that programmatically the DNR changed how the safety training is being delivered to the kids. It used to be a CD, now it is combined with an ATV program and is done on-site electronically. The companies that have created the on-site program put both of the trainings together, and if you are an off-highway motorcycle rider under age 11, you are not able to take the required training online. So we wanted that fixed. We also know that there are children out there who are not riding on public lands that are under the age of 11 and 12 that are on both ATVs and motorcycles that are riding without training. Our amendment changes the level so that the kids and consequently their parents receive the information that they need to keep their children safe while riding, whether it's on public lands or on private property, using a friend's machine, using the cousins and neighbors. Half of the reason we have training is for the kids and half of the reason is for the adults. I don't know how many times I've been in an informational booth and a parent has come up to me telling me how well their six-year-old does and an 850cc machine that's over 1,000 pounds. The kid can make it go. The kid does not know how to ride. So we need that education at as low as a level as we possibly can to get the parents from putting their kids on unsafe machines.
Thank you.
Oops. That's fine.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on line 1.20 of the 6 years, so what this says is that you're actually establishing a floor of 6 years so that three-year-olds are not going to be taking the training or...
That's correct. Currently, anybody under age 16 needs to have the training. However, if you're under age 5, you're really not getting the training message.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Oh. Identify yourself quickly and
Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement for DNR. Mr. Chair, just for the record on the amendment, DNR does see that there has been an increase in the number of injuries for people that are not old enough to take the ATV safety training. We'd really like to work with the user groups to devise training that is suited for people that are under the age of 11. The curriculum that's written currently is written at a sixth grade reading level with seventh grade terminology. We would like to work with these user groups to maybe find a way to get some training that's more suited to that age group. We'll continue to work with the groups to do that. But I just want to get that on the record.
Thank you, Chair. Anything else? Okay, so then, yep, I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 1673 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Whoops.
No.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, maybe I missed it. Did we pass the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, and I did. I'm sorry.
All those, the bill is passed. Okay. Yep, and House File 1293 will move to tomorrow as per CA instruction. With that, we're adjourned, members.